Ready to begin?
Looks like it. Can y'all hear me okay? It's not a very big room, so. My name is Steve Myers. I'm a journalist. I work at the Poynter Institute. It's a journalism training center in Florida, and we track the changes in news, and we help journalists figure out how to adapt to those changes. And I'm here with Soheib Attar, who will forever be known as the man who unwittingly tweeted the bin Laden raid. And we're going to talk a little bit here about what Soheib did the night of May 1st.
For you.
Yes, yeah. It was for us, right? And why was that citizen journalism? Talk a little bit about the network effect that carried him here, and then open it up to any questions. He has an interesting perspective being in the middle of an international news event like this. So we have a small room. I'm not monitoring the back channel, but if we're going too fast or too slow, you know, feel free to step up and let us know. We have plenty of things we can cover. So if you feel like it's going a little too slow, just let me know. And the good thing about 73 slides is they're all 140 characters, so it won't take any time at all. So I just wanted to start off by saying that we already know the end of this story, and so what we're going to discuss today is the beginning and the middle of the story. And it's interesting how the beginning is obviously about citizen journalism, and then the middle is about the network that carries the citizen journalist's information to us, which is obviously critical. So a little bit about Soheib. He's 34 years old. He's an IT consultant, grew up in Lahore, a city of about 17 million, and moved to what he calls a small town of Abbottabad. And it's about a million, you say?
Yeah.
A million people?
A bit less than a million.
Okay. And moved there to basically get away from the noise, the bustle, the distractions, and also to move to a safer place because of the terrorism that the bomb attacks that were going on in Lahore occasionally. And that factors into really his connections, and it's one of the reasons he was able to move this information around the world. So he has been on Twitter since
2007.
Okay. And at first he used Twitter in a fairly typical way. I'll just show you a little bit about what Soheib's life was like before the raid. He tweeted about politics, for instance, just basically sharing links. He looked for a kitten on Twitter for his son. He tells me that, how many kittens have you had?
He's been through 3 kittens so far, so this is the 3rd kitten now. They all ran away for some reason.
Have you found them all on Twitter?
2 of them.
Who knew? Okay. So Habe's in technology. He's an IT consultant. Has done a lot of programming in his life. So obviously, technology is a big part of what he tweeted about. And earthquakes are fairly common in Pakistan these days. So that's another thing that he and others would tweet about, that just like we would here. When he moved to Abbottabad, he opened a coffee shop, partly to have a place to gather with people. Right.
Yeah.
And so here's a twit pic of the coffee drink he was using. So all very typical stuff, nothing that would have made you think, like, you know, that, you know, he's some sort of journalist in waiting. So how did he become this guy? Essentially, what he did is he started off by doing what any of us would do, which is he witnessed something that was unusual, and he told others about it. So that's the first stage of what happened. And so here we have the tweet that we've all seen. Helicopter hovering above Abbottabad at 1 a.m. is a rare event. And then the next tweet is a bit of his signature humor, which I think it comes out, you'll see it comes across pretty well throughout. It turns out he's a pretty good writer. And then about maybe 9 minutes after that initial tweet, we have another tweet. So I just want to stop here and ask you, with that first tweet, this one, helicopter hovering above Abbottabad, what are you thinking at this point? What's your state of mind?
Well, I had just started working because I start my work at midnight, and I normally work throughout the morning, so I sleep at 7 or 8. So I just sat down on my laptop and started working when there was this noise. In the Abbottabad is a very small and quiet little town, so one of the reasons I moved there. So hearing a helicopter or even lots of cars at night is not very common. So the helicopter was circling around my house, above my house for a while. Then it stopped in the air for around 4 or 5 minutes, like it was hovering there, which was very suspicious because helicopters normally do not do that in Abu Dhabi.
There's no airport there.
There's no airport. There's a helipad, but it is probably used once every month or once every couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
That too for the army supplies or stuff like that. So you do not normally hear helicopters in the middle of the night, especially. So that is why I tweeted that tweet initially.
Mm-hmm. And this second tweet, I mean, it strikes me that you really don't seem to be taking it very seriously. I mean,
I just started working, so I was just getting into the zone. I was focusing on something rather important, so the helicopter was pretty distracting. So I really wanted it to go away. So mm-hmm. that is, I could only tweet about it.
Right. Okay. And then, how about here? What are you thinking now when you hear this explosion?
Yeah, after the helicopter went away, then there was this huge explosion. It sounded like it was on the ground and not in the air. Otherwise, I would have thought that the helicopter had exploded or something like this. But it was on the ground, so the windows of my house shook. I could immediately tell that it was not a burst tire or firecracker or something, because I've heard explosions in Lahore before.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that it was an actual explosion. So I was initially thinking that it may have been a terrorism incident. Somebody must have planted a bomb which had gone off, because Abbottabad is a military town as well, besides many other things. So I initially thought it was an attack, a terrorism attack on some military installation of some sort.
Okay. And it's about 1 a.m. or so.
Yeah.
You are the only one in the house awake?
Yeah, I'm the only one in the house. My wife and son were asleep. So when after the explosion, I checked up on them, but they were still fast asleep, so they mm-hmm. did not really hear the explosion.
So one thing I wonder is, did you really think anyone is even listening? Is anyone paying any attention to what you'd be tweeting in the middle of the night?
Yes, actually, most of my friends are in Lahore or in Karachi. They're both fairly huge cities. Karachi is the top 20 cities of the world in terms of population, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the people at night are awake on Twitter and tweeting and chatting with each other. So people the people who are normally in my social circle on Twitter, they're awake till 3 or 4 a.m. So we're usually talking about different stuff. So I knew somebody would be reading about it.
Who exactly would you be talking to, or who would be reading this?
Most of the people on Twitter are bloggers. So there was this initially small community of bloggers from Pakistan that transitioned onto Twitter. So most of the people are technology enthusiasts or professionals. A few of them are politically inclined. A few of them are journalists too. So mm-hmm. it's a small mix of around, I would say, 200 to 300 very active Twitter users.
So they're all awake. They're in a big city, and you are the only person awake in this relatively small
yeah.
town. Okay. Okay, got it. So now we have, I wanted to take you through some of the tweets that occurred next, because some people have said, well, just tweeting about a helicopter in the middle of the night doesn't make you a citizen journalist, and I would agree with that. But I do think that the things that he did next, I think he acted very much in that way. So here are some of those tweets that make me think that. Essentially what he did is he acted as a conduit for information. So can you just tell me, this user here, you know, do you know this person? And just
no, I do not know this person. He was following me, so he had some ties with Abbottabad. He had family there, so he was concerned about them. So he started asking me questions on what had happened. He was living in another city, which is pretty close.
Okay, so you're basically just answering him.
Yeah, like, I'm answering his questions if I have the information, or I'm trying to guess what could have happened if I don't have the information. So we were basically speculating initially.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started actively seeking out the information. I got in touch with a friend of mine mm-hmm. on Facebook chat, and we started to try to reverse engineer the facts.
Okay. We've got some more tweets that will illustrate that too. And this is actually this tweet right here where you're talking about the helicopter near Bilal Town. This is, how'd you get this information?
This information was actually given to me by the friend that I told you about. So we initially when the blast happened, he was probably one of the very few people who were online at that time in Abbottabad. So he got in touch with me over IM. He asked me if I had heard that. So I said, yes, I did. He lives on the other side of the town. So there's a 10 to 12 kilometers, which in miles is 5 or 6 miles, mm-hmm. I guess. So we deducted that the explosion must have been very huge and powerful for both of us to hear it. So we started talking about it, and he has some family that lives there. He tried to get in touch with them. Mm-hmm. He had some friends online at that time. So he got that information and he shared it with me.
Okay. So you talked about reverse engineering. Can you go into a little bit more detail? I'm interested in this idea.
Basically, the people who were talking to me at that time, like the people you showed the slides about, so we were just trying to reverse engineer what could have happened. So we were trying to gather all the facts and from those facts try to see the real picture, because the media was not there at that time. Abbottabad is a fairly small town, which is around 3 to 4 hours away from Islamabad at night. So if media had heard about it, they were probably on their way to Abbottabad from Islamabad, because there is a very small media presence and local media presence in Abbottabad.
So at this point, it's an hour or so, hour and a half after the tweet, after the raid,
actually less than that.
Okay. And there's no media. You're the only people who are able to really be talking
about this. Yeah, the first report on the traditional media that we heard were probably an hour or so later.
Okay. I notice there's a lot of confusion here. You can see in the next tweets that basically you're sort of given a lot of conflicting information.
Yeah, there was only a few channels were talking about it. So a website was saying it was a Pakistani helicopter that had crashed and it was a technical fault. Somebody was saying it was shot down by a missile. So there were all sorts of different stories in the air at that time.
Okay. So basically people just sort of speculating and trading rumors.
Yeah.
So here we've got you talking. Here we've got, you know, you're responding to someone basically trading. Do you know this person?
I know that she's a doctor who studied in Abbottabad. Abbottabad has a lot of medical schools, so I just know that she's somebody who studied in Abbottabad.
Okay, but other than that,
I don't know that person. I mean, I haven't met her or anything.
Okay. And we have trading some more information. Now, you said that you started to get some initial reports, and it starts to confirm this idea that it's some kind of helicopter wreck.
Yeah, the first reports online were probably... I actually saw them around an hour after the incident, mm-hmm. if you start from the sound of the helicopter.
Okay. And another thing that I thought was interesting is you're not just sort of passing around information, but you're trying to analyze it and sort of make sense of what's going on. For instance, you know, this is, you're just sort of speculating about whether it's terrorism or not in this tweet. What's going through your head at this point? I mean, are you...
Since I live in the city, so the event directly impacted me and the people who I was talking to. So we were just trying to see what could have happened, because we knew that the official story would probably not be the whole truth, so we were trying to reverse engineer the mm-hmm. facts and see the real picture of ourselves.
So this iPhone map, this is the one that you got from your friend?
Yeah, he actually talked to a classmate of his. Mm-hmm. So this image was uploaded by somebody living very close to the compound. So this is off by a kilometer or so, but it's in the general surrounding. So this was uploaded on Facebook. My friend gave this URL to me, and then I tweeted about it on Twitter.
Okay. One of the things we did as we were preparing for this is that Soheib shared with me the Facebook chat that that he had that night. Of course, the great thing about all these tools is that everything's saved. And so here we have his friend Azeem. This is after he's called his uncle, and you see in the middle where Soheib says, "Do share, I've got to spread the news." And then, you know, Azeem tells you about this conflicting, this is, He's the source of the information where you said that there would have been a crash and a flash.
His uncle lives very close to the compound where OBL was shot. So he was on the phone with his uncle, and he was getting the information through phone. And he was also in touch with a few friends online, and they were also giving him the information.
Mm-hmm. So this is pretty deliberate. I'm wondering, do you consider, you know, in retrospect, what does this make you? I mean, obviously, I believe it's citizen journalism, but you could argue that you're just a source or a tipster. I mean, what in your mind? How do you differentiate these activities?
Well, I think that if I witness an event and I just broadcast the information or the news or whatever I know about it, and then I stop, then that would probably make me a tipster. But if I go out and I try to investigate what actually happened, and I try to gather as much information as I can, maybe out of my own curiosity, but also to share with the world, then probably that would make me a citizen journalist. It wouldn't be a journalist because I'm not getting paid for it.
Right.
That is my definition of it.
Some journalists don't get paid for it.
Yeah.
Well, you think you can do this just behind your computer, not going outside?
I don't think it can be behind the computer only, because sitting at home, I would probably not get the information that would be beneficial to the audience that mm-hmm. I'm trying to talk to. So I did go to the compound the next day. I decided to take my camera with me. I took pictures of the compound. I shared them over the internet. Mm-hmm. I talked to the immediate neighbors of that residence. So I got some stories. I shared them over the internet and my blog. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. As long as we're in this in this Facebook chat, I think we'll appreciate this. There's in the process of having this chat, you basically you're explaining to Azeem what Twitter is, because he has no idea.
Yeah, because people in Ahmedabad are more into Facebook. Everyone's using Facebook for everything, videos sharing, image sharing, but hardly anybody was using Twitter at that time.
Right. So so he says, are you talking to ghosts on your page? And then of course you explain to them it's public, you know, the @ sign is how they get notified. And then you say you don't use Twitter, do you? Well, it is a very useful tool. So I mean, even in the middle of all this, you're sort of evangelizing. And then on the next slide, you say, well, yours is basically the most detailed information I have. And then go down to this third conversation, where Azeem says, you know, this guy just copy and pasted your tweet. And you say, no, that's a retweet. That's okay. So. And so we talked about this, that you were pretty much the only...
I was probably one of the two or three people who were on Twitter, and I was probably the most active one. So I had this search on Ahmedabad, which was constantly open in my tweet deck, because I was obviously living in the town, so I was interested about it. So I would see perhaps 3 or 4 tweets every week, 4 or 5 tweets, not more than that before the incident, about Ahmedabad. So I think I know only 1 or 2 names who were actually tweeting at that time from Ahmedabad.
And now?
Now, besides the spam, which is constantly flowing, so everyone's selling something with the Ahmedabad tag with it around it. But I do see more than 20 or 30 people who are constantly talking, and they are from Ahmedabad. So people are slowly adopting Twitter.
Including Azeem, because we look a couple weeks later, he says... I just think that's great. So you did, right? You gave him a little.
Of course.
Oh, good. Okay. Now, let's say this is all. Let's say it's not citizen journalism, and you know, you're not really convinced. I mean, I think that the fact that, as you said, you know, you go out, you take some photos. Now, this is the next day. Obviously, all the international media is in town, and you went out and you tweeted some photos, and you ended up sort of at this point, you're kind of a critic of the media, or maybe you're becoming a critic of the media because you can observe what they're doing, right?
Right.
And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But I wanted to see if you could describe. There's a blog post that you wrote that I haven't seen anyone describe this otherwise, and I wanted to see if you could tell me about how you got this story about the grandmother and the child and at the compound.
Yeah, the grandmother was actually my friend's grandmother. She was more than 70 years old, I'm sure. So we went to the compound. Her house was right next to in the next lane besides the compound. So we went to their roof and we took some pictures. But later on, I got to chat to her. So I was just curious about the people living there, what they were like, how they interacted with the general community there. So she told me stories about those people, that they were not very social, so only a couple of men from that household were seen around. But one story that really moved me was her interaction with a small child who lived there. He was around 7 or 8. She said it was a beautiful child. Her exact word was, he was a beautiful child, and he reminded her of her grandchildren. So one day she saw that child trying to pick up a pail of milk and take it to his home, because those guys, they did not get their stuff delivered at their doorstep. They used some neighbor's house for that. So she saw that kid and she saw that he could not pick up the pail. So she picked up that pail and she walked him to the house and she let him in. So she was, that day she was trying to, the only thing that was constantly on her mind at that time was what could have happened to that child, whether he survived or whether he died in the explosion. So that was something that really moved me. I wrote about it. Later on, we came to know that the child survived and the children were all, hands were bound and they were left in the compound. But at that time, she was really crying and was pretty upset about it. So I had to write about it to get it off my chest.
And so this is the last paragraph that we pulled out of this. I wanted to see if you could just read the last paragraph here, because as someone who respects good writing, I think it's good writing, and I think it's a really interesting perspective.
I wrote that I don't know if the child was Osama's son or even related to him, but for her sake, I do hope that the boy was amongst the children that were found outside the compound, hands bound after the raid. I hope that the stateless boy is not exploited by the governments, madrasas, social workers, or other types of vultures that are trying to benefit from his misfortune. I hope that in the years to come, the child is not punished just because of his association with Osama bin Laden, and I hope that he grows up to be a normal human being, as normal as possible given the unusual circumstances that he had to live through during the first 7 years of his existence.
I think it's really good writing, and I think it's interesting that he was able to come across this sort of thing precisely because he lived in the community and because he, you know, knew essentially where to find these sources. I mean, at the time, did anyone else report this?
No, actually, I did not see anybody else report about the people living there besides the incident itself. So the reports were mainly about Abbottabad and the raid and how people were not believing that he was dead. So the information, the focus was not on stuff like this.
They weren't interested in the story. Okay. One of the things I wanted to see if we could discuss really quickly is the nature of this sort of the handoff that you described. So you said basically, I'm not going to get paid to do this work.
Yeah, I was living there. I was curious enough to go and gather the information and spread it around because I thought it was important for people to know. But ultimately, I have my own work to go back to, so I can only report, if you can call it reporting, so I can only broadcast that information for a while, and then I have to get back to my normal daily routine. So at that time, it is obviously the media's job to take over and cover the story as it should be covered.
So do you see it as a competition of any kind between you and the media?
Not really. The only reason I was able to do that was because I was freelancing, so I was following my own schedule. I did not have a 9-to-5 job. Mm-hmm. So I could take out the time from my schedule to go there and investigate. I think normal people cannot probably do that.
So. Right. It's kind of like when we were discussing this, I thought of the analogy of, some people have said, I don't want a citizen doctor. You know, would you ever trust a citizen doctor? You know, they use that to describe their skepticism of people like Sohaib doing journalistic things. And actually, we rely on citizen doctors in certain times of crisis when we're in a, if there's some kind of car wreck, you know, we basically rely on someone to administer first aid. So in a way, I feel like it's first aid journalism or first responder journalism, where you have someone who's going to step in, and then later they're going to hand it off to someone who may have a more developed skill set, but it's essentially the same set of skills. I mean, clearly there are very advanced ways of behaving journalistically, and then there are some more basic ways. Witnessing would be, you know, some one of the more basic ways. But this sort of ladder of skills and the handoff is, I think, it's an interesting way to think of it. I don't know of anyone who lost their job through your citizen journalism. Do you?
No, I don't think so.
But it's something that we talk about all the time: is whether people like you are replacing journalists who go out to scenes of major news
events. I think I only wore the hat of journalism for a few days, and then I took it off.
Right, that makes sense. So I think we've got time to do you guys want to hear a little bit about the misinformation? He spread a few rumors, and okay, I'm getting some nods here. So not all of it was perfect, and so we've got a couple tweets. I just wanted to see if you could describe. This is the next day, right?
Yeah, it's the next morning, sometime around 7, I would say.
Okay.
So after tweeting about everything, I logged off for a few hours, 3 or 4 hours. Then I logged back in for a while. Then I thought I should go to the coffee shop and work from there. So I was walking to the coffee shop, actually. So everyone was talking about the explosion and the helicopter on the street. So I started hearing rumors. I talked to a few sweepers, people employed by governments who are sweeping the roads there. So I talked to a cab driver. So everyone had a different story to tell. Somebody was saying that a helicopter had crashed over a house and a family was killed. Another guy was saying that it was a foreign helicopter which had spies in it and the pilot had gotten away. So the police were searching from door to door and they had blocked the area. So all kinds of stories were in the air.
And you ended up, you tweeted these, and in retrospect, what do you think about the wisdom of tweeting that?
I think whatever information I was getting, I was broadcasting at that time because nobody else was doing it. So there was definitely a possibility of me broadcasting the wrong information. But normally what happens on Twitter is, at least in the circle I belong to, that if something like that is broadcast and later we come to know that it was incorrect, we normally try to fix that fact and we tweet about it again, that whatever I said was not wrong, it wasn't an explosion, it was thunder. So we try to fix that.
Okay. And that's just the way it works. It's not like you've ever heard.
That's how I practice Twitter usage, at least.
And that's pretty common for those of us who are following this area. We'll call it process journalism if you want. But there is some research that indicates, not in this case, I don't think this is an example of that, but that sensational, inaccurate information is retweeted more than the later corrections. And there's a researcher who's worked on this named Gilad Lotan. Is he in the room? He's in the very back. Very smart guy. Works for Social Flow. And so I will steal a slide from you. Craig Silverman, who works for Poynter, he coined the law of incorrect tweets. Initial inaccurate information will be retweeted more than any subsequent correction. And he uses this. This is a graph that some information that basically the first the green line is the tweet saying that the New York Police Department had ordered a news chopper out of the Occupy Wall Street area. And you see that it goes way up and, you know, of course, very high, a lot of interest. And then later, the information gets knocked down. You know, NYPD says, we don't even have the power to do that. We don't know what you're talking about. And so, you know, there's a later, the correct information goes out. But as you can see, it doesn't get to nearly the same point. And we can talk about more about why this happens if you want to get up. If anyone wants to talk about that more, we can discuss that. But it's sort of the nature of sensational information. And it's kind of an interesting sort of sidelight to this. As it turns out, the sensational information here was correct. So now we're at the stage where There are a lot of rumors around, right? President Obama hasn't given his speech, and basically now that there's a lot, you're starting to sort of put the pieces together. Okay.
Right.
So there are a few tweets here that illustrate that, and I want to show those to you. Again, fairly clever writing, I think. And now here, tell me about this tweet, this person, how you know this person, and how you came to see this.
After hearing about all these stories, I arrived at the coffee shop. I turned on my laptop, and I was simultaneously going through the Twitter timeline, and I was tweeting about it all. So this guy, Naqvi, he's a cousin of a friend of mine, and he lives in the United States. It's Atlanta, I think. Mm-hmm. So I saw his tweet, and it made a lot of sense that the helicopter and the U.S. president's speech must have been retired. I knew that the U.S. president had this speech because people were complaining about some TV show that he had interrupted for the speech. So it made sense, so I retweeted that. So that is what my first... introduction to the idea that it would have been related.
And you found this because of your text search on Abbottabad? Everything that says Abbottabad comes up in your tweet stream?
Yeah, it does. So there were a few tweets about the U.S. president's speech in my regular timeline because I was following people from the U.S., obviously. Mm-hmm. So this one turned out because of the Abbottabad keyword.
So there's been some other research on this in that, so he lives in the U.S. and he's a cousin of a colleague?
He's a cousin of an ex-colleague.
Okay. So somewhat of a weak tie. People who are from one place and live in another, there's been some research that indicates that they're particularly powerful and moving information around the world because they are following people from one place and yet they have the context in another place. So... This person is able to, he hears the buzz, he knows about this crash, and he's able to put the pieces together in a way that that very few people were able to do at this stage. So I think that's, and there are a few other people who I'll show you who sort of have this similar, they have a foot on two different continents, and they're especially useful in passing this information around. And so now your same sort of wry response here as to what you learn is going on. And again, this is just another, I don't even know who this user is, but this is basically, you know.
This is from my Abbottabad search stream. Yeah.
Do you know if the president has done his address at this point?
I don't think so. I think the address was done already, but I don't have a TV, so I was not following the U.S. news itself. I was only following Twitter, so I cannot be sure.
Okay. So one of the things I did, the reason I ended up, I started writing about this was I was interested in learning about how the news of this live tweeting got to me. I'm not a computer scientist, so I can't do any sort of massive research into the Twitter API, but I just basically did an anecdotal, I backtraced how the information got to me. I learned about it at 2 a.m., about 3 hours or so after the president's address. And so... I learned about a few interesting ways that this news got to me, and again, it shows sort of the power of single actors in a series of small overlapping relationships. So I want to describe this to you really quickly. Essentially, there's an important piece here in which a journalist who lives in the United States is from Pakistan. She retweeted this tweet in which Musharraf Zaidi, journalist?
Yeah, he's a journalist and he's a political analyst, so he's on TV shows quite often.
And you know him personally?
I know him through a friend. They both went to the same university.
Okay. So most likely he was following you that night. And so he's responding to someone else. Someone's giving him props for sending this tweet out earlier, and so he's responding to that. There's a journalist in the United States who sees the retweet of this, and so they start to get interested. And the journalist and her boyfriend, Chris Applegate, is a developer, and his girlfriend pointed out the tweet to him. And so he basically, he uses Google Real-Time, which is not available now. It was a pretty powerful way to look for this information. He does a search for tweets with Abbottabad that were posted before 10:30 or 10 p.m. the night before, so that he can eliminate all the citations of Abbottabad, because the President Obama has mentioned that word. So if he just searches for the word Abbottabad, you know, he'll get flooded with all the retweets from that. And so pretty quickly he sees Sohaib's first tweet, and then he and his girlfriend, they sort of give him the tag of the live blogger or the live tweeter. And I don't think that these are the only people who saw this information. Again, this is an anecdotal stream. There may be other people who found this. I mean, I think that there's probably just a massive wave of journalists moving towards you at this point. And so this is just one of those ways. So Chris and his girlfriend both tweet this, and you saw, because she tagged you. You see in your stream, and so now you respond, and this is how you know.
Yeah, these were actually her words that I retweeted about.
Right, and so now this is at 23:41. A minute later, now you start to get besieged.
Yeah, I was getting those Gmail alerts, so the media immediately started trying to get information about Abbottabad. So the initial few emails were about, they asked me to describe Abbottabad, what is it like, and mm-hmm. questions like that.
Okay. Again, that's a fairly funny response. You're fairly old. I mean, you are about as new media as you get, I suppose, in terms of news consumption. And so you're responding to BBC and other agencies.
Yeah, they were all trying to reach me, and I don't really watch TV or consume this news, so I mean, I didn't really want to get involved at that time. So actually, the first TV interview that I did was for Al Jazeera's The Stream program, and that I only agreed to because it related to the social media aspect of news.
That was the next day, right?
Yeah, that was around 24 hours later.
Right, okay. One of the first shows, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so but I have a little bit more discussion about the network and network effect. We can get into that, but I don't want to go. We're at 4:05 now. I want to see if you have any clarification questions, anything at all you want to bring up now, and then we'll move on from there.
How far is the compound from your house? From where
it's
you
around a couple of kilometers. So it's a valley, though, so I could hear the sounds. I could not see everything, of course, but the helicopters were, their sounds were all over.
How long would it have taken you to get to this place?
By car, probably 5 minutes.
Okay. Okay.
So you talked about not responding to a lot of the major news outlets. Were you worried that you would be exploited by them, or what was your hesitation there?
Actually, I did not have any motivation to talk to them, and I was sleepy because it was my time to sleep, so...
We've got a little bit more on sort of his comment, critique of the media that he came up with later. Do we, any other questions? You want to keep going? One more.
I'm very concerned about, like, the safety. I mean, you know, this obviously wasn't a private conversation, but it blew up.
Yeah, not my safety, but the safety of the town in general was obviously on my mind because it was an explosion, and Abbottabad has not had any terrorism attacks before the explosion, so I was mainly worried about the town itself, not my own safety. I mean, I was pretty safe as any other person.
I mean, after your tweets became, you know, widely public, were you
worried? Actually, no, because had Osama read my tweets, he may have had the chance to run away. So, I mean, so they were actually trying to be helpful for them.
I think that's pretty funny. Okay. So a little bit more on the network effect here. I looked at the number of people who took Sohaib's tweets to me, and we have him in the top left corner, and then at the very bottom, basically there are 8 people between me and Sohaib. Then there are 13 images here total, if I have my math right. And the last 4, I'm following all those people, so it's a dense concentration. A couple things I want to illustrate here is one that you take out Danny Sullivan at the end. There aren't that these people don't have huge followings, and it's just kind of amazing in a way that you know you could have a series of maybe 3,000, 4,000 followers, and you have these overlapping circles that can bring this information around. The two names in red that I've put in red, Both of those people have, as I said, a sort of a foot on each continent. Bina Sarwar, journalist from Pakistan, lives in the U.S. And Maha, same thing. She did some work in Pakistan, and so she has some of these sort of connections. And I think that, again, those are the sorts of people that are really valuable in terms of bringing this news to us. You know, it's interesting that one of the things that we don't really have a tool to do yet is all we can do is rely on the network to bring this information to us. We don't really have good ways to surface people like Sohaib early on. There's a tool that a researcher who was at Rutgers developed. He calls it Seriously Rapid Source Review. And it's essentially a way to try to surface these eyewitnesses before they sort of come to us organically through the network. And it's not available. We don't have that kind of tool now. I mean, basically all we can do are searches, text searches, and just basically try to, you know, comb through the network ourselves. But I don't think it's I don't think we have very long till we get to the point where we know of a news event and we can start searching for people who are eyewitnesses. One of the ways that this tool works is that it essentially looks for about 750 words that are signals that you witnessed something, heard, saw, whatever, and it looks for those tweets around an event and it surfaces them. It can identify whether you're a journalist. It looks for links and twit pics and things like that. So this is the sort of tool, should he get it built, if he gets the cooperation from Twitter, it will mean that we don't accidentally come across people like Sohaib. We're going to really have a systematic way to do that. And in this slide, I want to illustrate that as far as my whole eight connections go, I thought that was really short. As it turns out, it's larger than average. Facebook and Twitter users are only five hops away. You're only five hops away from any other Twitter user in the world. Same with Facebook. And again, it's this idea that the weak ties make the world small. It's weak ties like the tie between Naqvi and you, or Bina Sarwar and Musharraf Zaidi. These are the ties that sort of bring things together. In fact, you have an example with that with the journalists, right?
Yeah, the first journalist to get in touch with me was a BBC journalist. So she got my number through a common friend of ours. He's just friends on Facebook. I did not really know him before that night. So we did meet after the incident because he came to visit the compound. But before that, I did not really personally know him, but she was searching for my name. She got to my Facebook page. My phone number was hidden and was available only for friends, so she found this common friend that we both had. She asked him and he got my number for her, so that's how she got to me.
So one connection, one person between the two. And how well did you know him?
I just knew him through Facebook.
Okay.
So we also had some common friends, but I mean, I had not met him before that.
And then with the Time correspondent?
Yeah, with the Time correspondent, Musharraf Zaidi, and the Time correspondent, Umar is his name, both have a common friend, so they all went to university together, so I knew them through that friend.
Okay. Now we've got, we're going to take about 5 minutes and discuss sort of like what Sohaib's impression of the media was, because he was in the middle of this storm. Everyone, again, this wave of journalists went to reach him. So just tell me a little bit about what's the sort of the first thing they wanted to do is this nature of the exclusive. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, the first few journalists who managed to reach me, one of the questions that they asked were, have you talked to anyone else? So I said, yeah, I've talked to this person. Have you given any interviews? So they were trying to see who had gotten there before them. And then they wanted to get me to do an exclusive. So they were explaining to me what an exclusive was, that you'll talk to me if and only me, and nobody else will be able to take your interview. So they were trying to get me on that track. Then a few of them were expecting me to ask them for money. So they were on the phone with their headquarters, and they were asking them, how much does this guy want for the interview? So that was a strange experience.
Yeah, it's interesting how they're so concerned with the economics of it, and it hadn't even occurred to you at this point.
Yeah, of course. I mean, giving interviews is not my job, so I did not really want to make any money off of it. It's mm-hmm. just information, so no big deal.
And it's also interesting that they would want exclusives when the way they found out about you is that you were freely giving information on Twitter. I don't know how, but that's the mentality, I suppose. So now, but they want to basically, let's talk about some of the sort of the inaccuracies that you said that they got a lot of things wrong.
Yeah, actually, the first thing that I noticed was everyone was saying Osama bin Laden killed right outside Islamabad. Actually, it was in a mansion right outside Islamabad. So Abbottabad and Islamabad have a lot of distance between them. It's a 3 to 4 hour drive from there. There are 4 or 5 major cities there. So right outside Islamabad was, I think, a bit misleading because Islamabad is the capital. Of course, they wanted to associate it with the capital itself. But that was the first inconsistency that I could spot. So we were actually joking on Twitter that everything is right outside Islamabad if it's not Islamabad. So he could have been anywhere. So they were technically correct.
That's funny. And what were some of the other inaccuracies? We talked about distance from you to the compound.
They got most of the basic facts wrong. My name, for example, my spelling aren't very common, but they could have copy-pasted it from a blog, for example. So my name was wrong, my occupation was wrong. I was a web programmer, I was a web designer, I was an internet cafe owner. I mean, I was many things. So then my house was not right next to the compound. It was 2 kilometers away. Many media channels reported that it was right next to the compound. Then there were distortions of the story. So somebody wrote something like, I was sleeping at night when I suddenly heard the explosion, and I suddenly woke up and turned on my laptop and started to tweet about it. So there was a lot of dramatization of the actual story.
We also discussed that basically they all asked you the same questions. Can we talk about that and how you responded?
The first question that I got, and I still get it, is did you really not know that Osama was living in the same city as you? So it was, a bit accusatory. It sounded like, to me like, they were telling me that, have you really told us the whole truth? So that is still the question that I get most often, so whenever I talk about it. So I was getting questions repeated to me over and over again. Somebody was, one other question that they wanted was the same information from my own mouth. So everyone was saying, please replay the incident of this raid. So tell us what happened from the beginning. So I was repeating the helicopter story and the explosion story over and over again. So what I did was I wrote an FAQ about it, and I wrote all the questions and their answers. So I published it on my blog, and I handed out the URL to any email or any contact. So I told them just get the information from there, because I was repeating it over and over again.
That's great. And how'd that go, by the way?
It went okay, but I was still getting the same mail, so it didn't really work. So then I broadcast a tag on Twitter. So I said, if you have any questions, you can ask me using this tag, and then I'll write it down and answer your questions on the internet, so I don't have to do it over and over again. But I still get those questions basically every day.
And then there were some obvious factual errors. There are accuracy issues. They're asking you to sort of tell the story so they can get the words out of your mouth,
yeah.
Right? But then there were some sort of bigger issues about how they represented the town.
Yeah, I think the picture that the media coverage painted was a little biased. So they were, I had the feeling that they were trying to validate the stereotypes that they had about Abbottabad and life there, because. I'll give you an example on Fridays, the bearded people and wearing caps, they normally congregate outside the mosques after their prayers are over. So the first Friday after the incident, the mosques, everyone from the media was gathering around the mosques and trying to get their coverage. whereas there are lots of schools and medical colleges there as well, so nobody was going to talk to the students and nobody was getting their opinion. So then there was this incident about there was a documentary being shot on a rooftop, so I was talking to this cameraman, he was on the phone. So there was a shopping mall on one side of the rooftop and there were naked Afghan refugees children running on the other side and playing in the garbage and cows and the typical scene that you normally see in villages. So he explicitly focused on that part of the town and the mosque minaret. So and he was on the phone telling his headquarter about it that I've taken the images of the minarets and the mosque and all that. So I think that was not the complete portrayal of the town that that it should have been.
Why do you think they were doing that?
I think if you talk to people about some event and they say, we don't really care, we're here to study, so that's not really news to them. So I think they were just trying to get the material that suited their story.
So they're going for what they thought was the most exciting,
yeah,
sensationalistic story. After all your experiences, do you have any thoughts about what the media could do different or better?
Yeah, I think one of the issues that, being from a computer science background, that I find with the news reporting is the emotional content that is somehow injected into the text of the news that is reported. So you can read between the lines, you can write a news item in any way. You can portray something as being a heroic event or an act of cowardice. So I think there's a lot of emotion that is involved in the text that I write, I read as the news. So what I think is that somehow there should be a semantics or a system of some sort, some grammar that, just like computer programming languages, that you guys can use to sort of take out the emotional content and just focus on the facts. So of course it won't be English, but and if it won't probably be practical, but if we can get that kind of language, then I think the news reporting can focus more on the facts and less have less emotional content in it.
Okay, well, we've got plenty of other things we can talk about, but I don't want to take all the time, so I'll open it up and 10 minutes. All right, 10 minutes, let's do it. Any more?
I'll say it was fascinating to not have to rely on CNN, but to be able to go and, you know, actually hear from somebody who was there.
Anyone else? Thank you for that comment. One of the things, can you talk about...
Here's a question.
Oh. Do you have any regrets? Do you wish you had slept through it or been on vacation?
Not really, because as a result of me tweeting about it, I got to clarify many wrong concepts about the country that I live in. And, I mean, I got the chance to fix a lot of things that would not have been fixed otherwise. So I would do it again if I have to.
You've been pretty active in engaging with people who are talking about it afterwards, right?
Yeah, I've been trying to hold as many conversations as I can, given my limited time, but I try to correct incorrect concepts about Pakistan or life in general or Abbottabad when I can.
Have you got any book authors? Or
yeah, people were contacting me about book offers initially. I mean, they wanted to pitch the idea of my book to multiple publishers, stuff like that. But I didn't really think it was... I mean, this story is probably worth one chapter in a book. It's not a very big book itself.
How many Twitter followers have you gained in the past year?
The max that I got to was around 105,000. Which is not a huge amount. I mean, I see people with 1 million or 2 million followers. So right now it's something close to 70,000.
How many did you have before?
750, 800, something like that.
How has that affected your use of Twitter? Like, what have you done differently?
I think I've decreased the frequency of the things that I... frequency of my tweets and the... things that I tweet about are normally things that I wish to share with my audience and followers. So I do not normally tweet about things that will not matter to them, so as not to pollute their timelines. I mean, I don't want to spam 70,000 people.
So you're fairly restrained.
Yeah, I don't tweet about what I'm eating normally or what I'm doing. So.
Do you tweet about kittens?
Yeah, I do.
That's different. Question in the back?
Yeah, I wonder, were there other people writing about this in Urdu who just didn't get the visibility that you were getting because of the language?
The issue is that Urdu is not very common on the internet. And Twitter was just recently translated to Urdu, so they don't have an Urdu interface, first of all. And secondly, people do not use an Urdu keyboard, which is a right-to-left language. So people, what they do is normally write Urdu in Roman script. So, but I don't know of anybody who was doing that, because on news sites or on Twitter, it works on Twitter or on text messages, but Roman script, Urdu does not work on news sites. So I did not see anything like that.
Okay.
How do you get your news?
I still use Twitter, so if there's some news that is really important, my circle of friends, which is mainly about, I mean, they tweet about Pakistan, they tweet about technology, stuff that matters to me. So if something's really important, everyone's discussing it, so I can normally get the cue and search about it myself.
Okay. All the way in the back.
Can you speak a little bit about the community's reaction to the event? Was there empathy? Was there just kind of a sense of shock?
Yeah, people were actually happy for the death of terrorists, but they were really frustrated about the invasion of sovereignty that the attack meant. So their opinion was mostly that if the U.S. government had conducted the operation with the help of the Pakistani army, then things would have been pretty all right. So they were mainly concerned about the sovereignty issue and not about the death itself.
Okay.
Is there any journalism going on now looking at who might have helped Osama get the compound to assist in
it? There's actually a whole commission. It's called the Abbottabad Commission. It consists of five or six judges, senior judges. So it's sitting in Islamabad right now. They're compiling a report about whatever happened. It's not journalism as such, but it's more of a government-initiated commission. So they're interviewing people. I was actually called there myself to verify the exact timings of the attack, because my tweets have the timestamps right there, and there was no other record, so they wanted to ask me the time span between my tweets and the actual events. So they're still working on that report, last time I heard.
So I think we've got some time to do this. I'm glad we can. I'm not going to claim that this has anything to do with journalism, but I think it's pretty amazing. So tell us about what happened with the helicopter, the parts of the helicopter, and...
Yeah, the helicopter, when it was blown away, I think it scattered all over the field. So journalists were visiting the compound, and whoever could find a piece of the helicopter, they were just picking them up as souvenirs. So the police were actually letting them keep them. So we went, me and a journalist friend of mine, we both went to the compound, and we got a box full of those pieces. So we were actually trying to... I was actually going to bring one for Steve, but I forgot about it.
I wish you had. But no, that's not the best part about it. What did you do with them?
So we filled... The friend of mine, he filled up a carton with those pieces, and he got them to my coffee shop. And later on, we were trying to see what exact model of the helicopter it was. So there were part numbers written on a few of the pieces. So we Googled for them, and we... came out to, I mean, we reached the same exact model that was used in the actual attack. So we got to the exact model using those pieces and Google.
So there we have it. That's a democratization of information. Anything else? We've got a few more minutes. Good questions so far. So thank you. And we also, our email addresses and Twitter handles are up there if you want to reach us.
Talked about some of the inaccuracies of your information. But knowing how much the formal media was inaccurate, even when you, you know, created pages and clearly tried to provide them all the facts, what are your thoughts about, you know, your kind of journalism versus traditional journalism and a responsibility that we have to maybe right that ship a little bit?
I think that, profession is software, so if we are off by a character, we cannot get a program to work, as opposed to journalists who can basically write whatever they want. So I think you can probably use some peer review or, I mean, some kind of audit, maybe after the news is reported, that could probably help you, get to a better model to follow.
What if you could break the story, like the one inaccurate piece of information meant the story was totally blank? I bet we would try harder to get it right.
Yeah.
Can you update us on what's gone on at the compound since this has happened?
It was destroyed. It was demolished, and that's the end of it.
Yeah. Time period, though, that it was there versus when it was destroyed.
It was destroyed recently.
Right. So tell us about how the people in the community treated it. Was it a shrine? Was it?
People were actually coming to see it out of curiosity, but the government was probably afraid that it would turn into a shrine because the anniversary is just coming over, so they probably destroyed it because May is right ahead. So.
Okay.
I understand the Chinese government was invited in to inspect the helicopter. Is that true, or is that misinformation?
Yeah, I heard about that myself, and there were a few government cars in the area when that news was spread, so it is a possibility.
All right. Well, we covered a lot of ground. Thank you so much. It was really enjoyable.